Hey everybody, it's me, W. Kamau Bell. You know me. Right now, I'm the new interim host of the ACLU's podcast at Liberty, but today, I'm coming to you as a fellow American who is going through the American experience. Whew! America's really Americaning, everybody. It's been over 24 hours since the news of Trump's victory. So we all know that means we need to pay attention. I know for certain that come January, after the inauguration, we need to pay attention to what's going on, what's coming out of that administration. Our rights and liberties will be put on notice, and we're all going to need a plan. And we don't want to wait until the inauguration day to come up with that plan, so that's what we're here to talk about today. The best part about being associated with the ACLU, other than having good lawyers in my Rolodex, I'm old, I still say Rolodex, is that I can have conversations with people at moments like this when we're all sort of trying to figure out what happens next. So today is a great day. I'm speaking with Cecilia Wong, the ACLU's National Legal Director and one of the people at the epicenter of ground control. She oversees more than 200 lawyers and staff in the National Legal Department, supports legal staff at all 54 affiliates, and directs the ACLU's work in the Supreme Court. You know, just light work, as we call it, light work. What's more, she knows how to fight the Trump administration's attacks on democracy because she's done it before. She ain't new to this. She's true to this, as you say if you were saying things that were popular to say 5 years ago. As the deputy legal director, she's helped the fight against the 2017 Muslim ban. We'll talk about that. The border wall, the family separation policy, and the citizenship question on the 2020 census. In other words, she's like a Swiss Army knife of civil rights. And also, she's from the Bay Area, so we love her extra more because we love people from the Bay Area extra more. Anyway, this conversation was great, and you're going to be surprised. It's a lot more light and fun than we expected, but we need light and fun right now as we get through whatever happens next, so enjoy. Hello, Cecilia. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you, Kamau?
I mean, that's a loaded question, and it's going to be a loaded question for the foreseeable future.
Tough to answer these days.
Yeah, so I actually meant that in the very sort of podcasty way, but then I realized, no, I mean that in the human way. How are you? How are you doing today in this space in your body?
I am doing well under the circumstances. I have been doing a lot of reading, reflection about literal ancestors and ancestors in the movement in order to fortify myself for what's to come.
Yeah, I hear you on that. That's a great way to and thinking about literal ancestors, reading about ancestors. Something occurred to me shortly after the election results came in. I was like, okay, I got to first take care of myself. That means my physical body, my mental state, my psychological state. Shout out to my therapist, Cliff. And then I got to take care of my family. And, you know, it's my wife, my kids, my 87-year-old mom. My dad lives in Alabama. He's mostly fine, but I got to, you know, he's included in that. And then if I can get that done, then I can sort of look out to my friends and then my community. It's sort of like, I think that's the sort of like, and then if I get that community, then you can get to like the bigger things. But I think it has to be sort of done in steps. And I think that especially going forward over the next era of America, like really making sure that we're taking care of ourselves, not in a selfish way, but in a way so that we're more able to take care of other people.
That's right. Taking care of ourselves and each other. I think that's the order of the day.
Yeah. What was this election night for you? Where were you at? Where did you take it in? What happened when the results came in? How did you experience all that?
In many ways, election night, Tuesday night, was an echo of Trump's first presidency for me. I'm a subscriber with the San Francisco Opera. My mom was a huge opera fan, and I still go in memory of her and to keep something that was really special for us going. So I had to change this performance into election night. And I was thinking to myself when I was, you know, changing that ticket, oh my God, is it really okay for me to be sitting in the Opera House on election night? But I decided to go ahead, and my plan was if I need to leave during intermission, I can do that. And the reason I say it was an echo of the first Trump presidency is that on January 27th, 2017, Trump's first Friday in office, the fifth business day of his presidency, he issued his first Muslim ban executive order. And that night, I was at the ballet in the same opera house here in San Francisco. And I was on my phone, I remember, talking to our lawyers about the lawsuit we were about to bring, the first of what turned out to be 28 lawsuits against the Muslim ban alone, right? And so here I was this past Tuesday night sitting in the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco and checking my phone and looking at the election results and had really this sense of, here we go again. Here we go with the work that is cut out for us going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I remember when the ACLU's, all the sort of lawyer, ACLU lawyers and lawyers of all sorts went to the airports to support people during the airports and the Muslim bans. I did feel a sense of pride in that moment of being associated with the ACLU.
Yeah, it's a real privilege to feel that you're part of something bigger, a community, and it's actually overlapping communities that are coming together with our work in mind. What about you, Kamal? What were you doing on Tuesday night as the election results were coming in?
It sort of has been a thing where every election night we invite Mike Johnson over. I call him White Mike Johnson because he's the only Mike Johnson I know who's a white guy. so we have all sort of like grown up and grown old together. And so now our kids are all there watching the election results come in. And it's interesting because my kids, and this is probably certainly somewhat like I did, had have a real sense of what's going on in the world and the election and how different candidates, how different presidents will affect the country. And I was both proud of them for understanding the stakes and also sad for them that they understood the stakes. So I'm like, I'm sure there are friends of yours who have no idea what this means. But and I wish you didn't have to know, but I feel like if I am who I am, it would be negligent for you not to understand the stakes of this election. But can you talk about, let's talk for humans as a second. There's a couple of areas that President-elect Trump has really focused on in his campaign that I think are, and that the campaign generally focused on, that I think people are going to be curious about what the ACLU is prepared to do. One is the trans community. Can you talk about what the ACLU's thoughts are about that and what their plans, what the ACLU's plans are around that?
Sure. You know, the ACLU is at the lead, along with partner organizations, in defending transgender Americans from the most vicious personal, almost physical attacks that Trump has said he will launch as president of the United States. So policy-wise, Trump says that as president, he's going to rescind federal policies that prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. These are protections that have been in place. And he is going to assert that our really core anti-discrimination laws that Congress has passed, like Title VII, don't cover anti-LGBTQ discrimination. He has said he's going to deny Medicaid funding to any hospital that provides hormone therapy to trans youth, cutting off that medical care, life-saving medical care nationwide, and not just in the 24 states that have enacted laws to ban that health care, that basic health care. He has said he's going to use federal law, laws that are meant to protect civil rights, as a way to hammer at state-level pro-LGBTQ civil rights protection. So he has announced all of these ways in which he will be attacking not just transgender Americans, but other LGBT people. And we are, number one, we are in court already, as you probably know, defending transgender adolescents in the Supreme Court. Our colleague Chase Strangio is going to be up there at the lectern, the first openly transgender advocate to appear before the Supreme Court.
Wow.
As an oralist. He is extraordinary. He's just a brilliant lawyer.
Yes.
And just a community champion, human rights champion. So he'll be arguing the case on December 4th in the Supreme Court. The issue is whether transgender people have the same rights against sex discrimination that everybody else does. Right? So in the 1970s, up until the 1970s, you know, sex discrimination was okay in the United States of America, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In the 1970s, thanks to the litigation of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as an ACLU lawyer, among others, the Supreme Court said, okay, we recognize that when states come into court defending their laws that discriminate against women, so for example, laws like women can't be bartenders or women cannot be lawyers, right? The states would always come in before the 1970s saying, this is for the good of women. We're doing this to protect women, the weaker sex. So the Supreme Court said in the 1970s, in response to ACLU litigation and litigation brought by other women's champions, okay, we recognize that this sort of this guise of benevolence, you know, we need to deal with that. And to deal with that, what we're going to say is we are going to apply heightened scrutiny. We're going to look very carefully at laws that discriminate against people based on sex. That is exactly what Tennessee's SB1 law is, banning healthcare for trans adolescents. And we're in court trying to defend the idea that trans people have basic rights against sex discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
Yeah, that's Chase is amazing, and I'm so happy to know that he's leading the charge there. The other thing that candidate Trump was talking about that I think we have to think about now that he's President-elect Trump and soon to be President Trump, and he's said this in many different ways. He's talked about immunity for police officers. And even at one point, and, you know, with Trump, it's like you say, he can say it's a joke, but he talked about actually saying letting cops do what they want to do for a little bit of time without any repercussions. And so it's just which is very scary for communities that feel like they're already at the business end of police in unjust ways too often. So can you talk about specifically around policing? And if you want to talk about prison, too, that's just another we can get into any of that.
Sure. You know, it's interesting. The Trump administration was mostly very harmful when it came to the criminal legal system. And, you know, there are limits naturally on what the president of the United States can do on the criminal legal system. Most of that happens at the state level. But what Trump did was, as you say, hold himself out as a champion for excessive force. You know, things he even said during his campaign rallies, like, you know, things he did even earlier in his life, talking about the Central Park Five, talking, siding with police, not just police in general, but those spokespersons among police who are out there fighting, as you said, for immunity when it's been proved that they violated people's constitutional rights by beating them up, by killing them, by discriminating against them. And so we're also really concerned about the harm that that President Trump will do in the realm of prisoners' rights and upholding the basic dignity, health, and safety of people who are incarcerated in federal prisons. The one you know, kind of silver lining or one bright light during Trump's first term is that we worked with him. That's right. The ACLU worked with Trump, the Trump administration, to get the First Step Act of 2018 passed. It was massively important in reducing mandatory minimums in federal sentencing and undoing the damage of a lot of discriminatory sentencing that happened in the 90s and early 2000s. You know, his administration thwarted the full implementation of the statute in various ways. And so, you know, I think the criminal legal system is an area of nuance for us where we are going to certainly hold Trump accountable for things like trying to trumpet the, you know, police officers when they attack people, particularly people of color. We are going to be looking for working with state and local level officials to try to reduce the situations, the number of situations where there's a violent encounter between the police and someone in the community, including advocating for state and local policies that protect people from police abuse. So from torturous methods of execution to pressing forward with the sentencing reform that Trump administration said it was for, to protecting people from police abuse, will be in the courts and working at the state and local level to try to stop Trump from, you know, further militarizing the police, further, you know, unleashing the police in ways that that would be very dangerous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So let's go to the next question. What's the plan? What is the ACLU master plan? How can I help? How can listeners help? I love that you turned around to like get the plan. Like,
here's
look at that.
Here's the literal plan.
Wow. That is for people listening on the podcast. She's holding up the literal plan. It's in a freshly, probably still smells fresh from the printer. It's a fresh binder of plans.
And
it's not concepts of plans. It's plans.
It's not concepts of plans. They're actual plans.
Okay.
So listen, we've been getting our plan together for the possibility of a second Trump presidency for over a year. And we have done legal analysis. We've done political analysis. We have taken a hard look at the many plans or concepts of plans that Donald Trump has come up with. And so, you know, we are ready to go. And we have lawyers who are actually working on legal papers that are meant to be ready to go when Trump takes office in January. And we also have plans that we've been talking about with state and local officials around the country who are interested in joining the fight to defend and protect civil rights and civil liberties for people in their communities. So that is also part of our plan. Things are already in the works, and I know that all of our ACLU supporters and listeners here are going to be plugging into these plans as we get ready for January.
One of the things that President-elect Trump, as I'm learning to say, was very effective in his first go-round in the presidency was appointing judges that sort of reflected his ideological bent. As the ACLU is preparing to, like, file lawsuits, how does that calculus work? Because it's not—you sort of know that, like, he has politicized these appointments in a way that means that, like, it's not necessarily—you know, I don't know if impartiality—actually, I know. Impartiality doesn't exist, but he has specifically appointed judges who have an ideological bent that matches his.
So it's true. Donald Trump, as president, reshaped the federal judiciary in important ways, and particularly the Supreme Court, which went, of course, from a 5-4 anti-civil rights, anti-civil liberties majority to a 6-3 hostile majority. So that's just a fact that we have to deal with. But I'll say this, litigation, whether it's in federal courts or state courts, will remain a really potent weapon that we have in the fight to protect and defend and advance our civil rights and civil liberties, including in the second Trump administration. The first thing I would say is that do not count out Joe Biden, okay? President Biden appointed a lot of really outstanding judges, and I want to give the Biden administration real credit that I think Biden made more inspired choices and appointed his appointments overall are the most diverse group of judges, federal judges, that we've seen. He did better than President Obama. He did better than President Clinton and appointed, I'm not talking just about racial diversity or gender diversity. He appointed judges who are former ACLU lawyers. He appointed judges who are former public defenders. They're going to add to the overall picture of the federal judiciary. Biden appointed almost as many federal judges as Donald Trump did in the lower courts, in both the federal district courts and the federal courts of appeals. Litigation is we're the firefighters, right? When the president, when the governor, when any government official goes after people's rights by taking action, you know, you can talk all you want about the political conditions or the public opinion conditions that led us to be in this situation. But the first thing you need to do is put out the fire. You need to try to stop the president from taking this illegal action that hurts people's civil rights or civil liberties. And that's what litigation is. Don't forget that under in the first Trump administration, we had Trump-appointed judges who ruled for us in cases we brought challenging Trump's immigration and border policies. Don't count out Republican-appointed judges. They are oath-bound to interpret and apply the laws passed by Congress and the U.S. Constitution. And so, you know, we are approaching the federal courts the same ways we always have been. Of course, two things we are doing differently. One is a renewed focus on state courts and state Supreme Court strategies. As you know, Kamau, we have 54 state affiliates, and lawyers at each of those affiliates are in state courts day in, day out. We have a new state Supreme Court initiative at the National ACLU with a team of lawyers who are putting together a playbook by going state by state and looking at the opportunities that are built into state constitutions, which are oftentimes more protective of civil rights and civil liberties. And what we need is to work a lawsuit or a legal strategy up through the state court system to the state Supreme Court to establish and make real the promise in those state constitutional provisions. So that's one thing in response to an increasingly hostile U.S. Supreme Court. And the other thing, you know, back to my point about not counting out the federal judiciary, you know, Biden has reshaped the federal courts, and that's, you know, changing things as Trump left them. And, you know, we have still been winning cases, including in the Supreme Court of the United States. So we'll keep going with the litigation. We are, you know, you as a good lawyer, you're going to tailor your legal arguments to the court that you're dealing with.
Yes.
Right? This court
It's like being a stand-up comedian. Like if you sort of get a sense of what the crowd is, you go, okay, let me move these jokes around a little bit. If this crowd's a little drunker, let me start with the dirty stuff. It's yeah.
Kamau, can we hire you as a consultant? I think we need to figure out how to work more jokes.
I'm down.
Legal arguments before courts.
That's great. That'd be great. So, yeah, so you're saying that the lawyers know who the judges they're going to go up against and therefore know how to, like, how that judge has ruled in the past, that judge's temperament, and are good enough to temper their, to frame their arguments for that
exactly.
Judge. And what about the states? Can they build some sort of firewall protection against the things that the Trump administration wants to do?
I think Trump is going to be, he has said that he is going to be even worse during his second presidency compared to his first presidency when it comes to things like going after the state officials that he considers to be his enemies, his political rivals, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we're getting ready for at the ACLU, and we have had conversations with state officials about this, is Trump could try to use this very old federal law called the Insurrection Act.
Yeah.
right, to try to deploy National Guard military troops to quell protests, right, that are happening in cities around the country where citizens and, you know, American communities are rising up to literally take to the streets and oppose his policies as he rolls them out. And so Trump has said, I'm going to deploy the National Guard. I'm going to, we saw this last time around, right, when he was president. He deployed federal law enforcement agents in Portland, Oregon. We saw federal law enforcement out there using excessive force, beating up protesters, and in some cases, even journalists or street medics who were there in support of protest or to observe and report on protest. We'll be out there trying to protect the rights of people who want to speak out.
I always think it's helpful because I just Googled this because I'm like, isn't there some year that sounds like it's from before time started? Yeah, the Insurrection Act of 1807.
That's right.
I think it's always, it's good to mention that that's, it's a law from 1807. And I'm pretty sure, I don't know, I don't want to, I'm not a lawyer, but laws from 1807 should be looked at real carefully before we enact them. Just generally, I would say that.
Yes,
yeah.
I think that's right. And my response as someone who is a former public defender who came out of immigrants' rights work and is a former director of the ACLU Center for Democracy, which houses our free speech work and our voting work. Donald Trump takes all of the free rein that Congress over the centuries has given to presidents, and he will do whatever he can with it. And so there are so many situations where, you know, Trump uses some law that's sitting around like a loaded weapon, where Congress, you know, administrations of both parties and the American people have said, oh, well, of course, the American president should have the power to do, you know, whatever he needs to. And so I think there's a real need in the long term to not rely just on normative expectations that presidents are acting in good faith and actually set some hard legal limits on what the president can do.
So let's talk about, I love to talk about the grassroots. That's where I come into this. I don't know if you know, I have a degree in nothing. and the grassroots is where I think I've find my best work and also the best way I can sort of highlight people who are doing the work. Let's talk about what grassroots mobilization.
Sure. And I'd love to get your thoughts on this too, but I can start. This is going to be something that's hard to say and hard to hear, right? One of the big lessons in reflecting on Trump's first presidency, really, really hard pill to swallow, is what happened to the grassroots energy that rose up in opposition to President Trump's policies, right? You mentioned already that it wasn't just lawyers who mobilized to U.S. airports on the evening of January 27th, 2017, and the following, you know, 2 days, Saturday and Sunday. It was regular people, right? And then what you saw was a mass flowering of turnout, right? Of people, regular people. It was very much organized. People worked on this.
Yeah, for sure.
There's
for sure.
labor involved, and hundreds of thousands of people turn out in cities around the country to protest the Muslim ban, to protest against Trump's entire platform as the newly elected president. What happened after that, Kamal? Where did the people go? And this is what keeps me up at night. The Supreme Court ultimately upheld the third version of Trump's Muslim ban. We forced him to water it down twice, right? We blocked version one in court. We blocked version two in court. And then the Supreme Court upholds version three, right? There was not 100,000 people in front of the Supreme Court. You know, all the people who were appalled and horrified, like their hair standing on end about how Trump separated babies from their parents when they came to the border seeking asylum. Where did the outrage go? So an important part of our plan is that we've learned from that experience and have, at the ACLU, retooled our advocacy team so that we can turn those big moments, Muslim ban, airport protests, you know, the family separation horror, take those moments around court cases, around anything that, you know, legislation passes, and make something organic, make something that can blossom out of a moment that we are building. So, you know, what do you think? I mean, you participated in protests, I know, and, you know, despite claiming to have a degree in nothing, I think you do have a degree in, you know, understanding what moves people. So what what do you think? How what are the ways we can be more successful on the grassroots mobilization piece?
I think of this as like working out. You don't do leg day at the gym every day. You know, you have to figure out different things you do. You know, some people never do leg day, but you know, but I think you have to like, you have to think of, there's different ways you can express maintaining, fighting for this American experiment called democracy. And the more you sort of vary it, the better you'll, the more you'll be able to maintain it.
Yep.
Wait, you're interviewing me. That wasn't supposed to happen.
Oh,
what just happened? You just flipped the script. You just, I'm sitting here.
I thought we were having a conversation. Excuse
me. Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. We were I appreciate that. No, I thank you. You know, I think it's important. People ask me all the time, how do you find humor in this? I think people who are doing this work naturally find humor in this, because how could you do the work without finding some humor, some levity in there? So thank you for that.
That is exactly right. We have to find the humor and the beauty and go to, you know, I always say it's the artists who will save us, not the lawyers, not the lobbyists, not the advocates. It's the artists who will save us.
And I say it's the lawyers who will save the artists. So like,
we all have our job, as we said. We all have our job.
Before I get you out of here, because I know you got a lot of work to do because you work at the ACLU and so the streets is hot right now. What's the rallying cry? What do we want people out there who are listening to this? What can they do? How can they support? What does the ACLU need from us to get the work done?
I'll say two things in response to that. First, I'll share a little bit about why I feel obligated to do this work. My parents were immigrants. They're no longer with us. But my mom in particular was a huge champion of the ACLU. And as immigrants and as Asian Americans, they went through a lot of racism, a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment, and made a lot of sacrifices in order to left a lot behind in order to come to the U.S. And my mom invested everything she had in me, so that I could be a lawyer at the ACLU, fighting for immigrants, fighting for trans folks, fighting for everyone who is in a position of having to defend their basic civil rights and freedom and humanity at the end. And so that's why I go to work every morning. That's why on Wednesday morning, I was ready to go. I would say steely resolve is what I felt Tuesday night and every day since. People have worked against much greater odds. The Black-led civil rights movement, Black Americans throughout our history, the history of this country, have faced down greater odds and prevailed. And as Martin Luther King said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And so the rallying cry is, you know, take care of each other, to go back to what we started with. Take care of each other. Take care of yourself. It is hard work bending that arc.
Yes, yes.
But we are going to do it.
We are.
And the second thing I would say is about hope and about prevailing despite the headwinds. Doing the work, even though you are not guaranteed victory, going back to the Muslim ban, okay, the Supreme Court ultimately upheld the third version of Trump's Muslim ban about 500 days after that first night he issued the first version. So between January 27th of 2017 and when the Supreme Court finally upheld it, we brought 28 lawsuits, right? We got literally countless people, but definitely thousands and thousands of people who had valid visas to come into the United States and who were being blocked by the Trump administration's customs and border protection officials at some airport, blocked from coming in with their valid visa. We got those folks in. Each one of those thousands and thousands of people was trying to rush to the deathbed of a loved one in the U.S., was trying to contribute to American intellectual life, mm-hmm. you know, to go to a job at a U.S. university or to attend a conference, maybe on climate change, right? They were coming as immigrants, including our first two clients, two Iraqi men who had helped the U.S. military during the war in Iraq and had visas to come and immigrate to the United States. Those two were blocked, in addition to many more, right? These are the people Donald Trump was blocking. Why? Because they're Muslim. They're from a predominantly Muslim country, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Each one of those thousands of people was able to come into the United States and do what they needed to do here in America. And so even though at the end of the day, people say, oh, it's hopeless, all hope is lost, it's a 6-3 Supreme Court that's against us, and we lost the Muslim ban, and we lost on this, and we lost on that, the story does not end. It doesn't start, the story does not start, and it does not end with a Supreme Court decision. The story starts and it ends with the power of the people who are fighting for rights, for freedom, and for our basic humanity. And I'll leave it at that.
I think you left it at the very best place you could. Thank you for dropping that mic like that. I think knowing that you have such good humor and such fierce intellect and such a strong commitment that you're carrying your family's legacy forward. I always think of it as like the black baton that my grandparents handed to my mom, and now she handed it to me. And I want to make sure when I hand it to my kids, it's not heavier than when it was handed to me from my mom. So you're doing that same thing. And you can, I always think of when I think about, like you said, when people, you think about how hard the people before us worked. I always think of the ghost of Harriet Tubman showing up being like, what, Kamau, you're having a hard time directing a documentary?
What would Harriet say?
Yeah.
What would Harriet do?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that, like, you have to sort of give some perspective. Give yourself some grace and also give yourself some perspective. So thank you, Cecilia. It's really great to talk to you.
Thank you, Kamau. It's been a real pleasure.
Boom. That's how it's done, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of At Liberty, and you did, so let's just say you enjoyed this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also, this is the thing that you hear people say, but it's actually important, rate and review it, because that helps the algorithm. And when you rate it, just give it 5 stars. Even if you have critical things to say, give us 5 stars for effort. It's the ACLU. Come on, everybody. We really do appreciate the feedback. Until next time, I'm W. Kamau Bell. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU. This episode was produced by the ACLU's Jessica Herman-Weitz, Gwen Schroeder, and Cindy Tsai, and Who Knows Best Productions, W. Kamau Bell, Kelly Rafferty, and Melissa Hudson-Bell. This show was edited by the folks at Ultraviolet Audio. And friends, you heard Cecilia. Take care of each other. Take the baton. Pass the baton. Don't give up. And remember, friends, don't let friends give up the fight.